dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Recently, we had a chance to visit with Peter Husey, a man who has studied closely and been extraordinarily effective in educating the rest of us about matters involving nuclear forces, space, arms control, and the like. He has a consulting operation he calls Geostrategic Analysis. He is also the director for strategic deterrent studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. Always a welcome guest here. We wanted to come back and finish a topic that we couldn't get into the other day, namely China and its nuclear weapons programs, and specifically the fact that it seems they're building massively and unconstrained by even the figment of arms control. Peter Husey, welcome back. Good to have you. Tell us about it.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
Tell us about what the Chinese are up to, Peter.
Well, most estimates are total guesses on what the Chinese have, and it's 300 warheads, some of which are aimed at the United States. The Defense Intelligence Agency says they're at least going to double that in the coming decade, somewhere between 600 and 800 warheads. But worse than that is they decided in 1981, the Chinese did, to proliferate nuclear weapons technology through Pakistan to North Korea to Iraq to Libya and Iran. They successfully did this with Pakistan and North Korea. And what they see is North Korea, nuclear-armed North Korea, the reason that Kim, the leader of North Korea, keeps throwing these rockets out in the South China Sea and the Sea of Japan, is they want to intimidate the United States to make a deal which recognizes North Korea as a nuclear power. That will cause, in the Chinese view, the Japanese and the Koreans to try to make a deal with the Chinese and North Koreans, which is, okay, you guys are the big boys and we can't rely on America anymore. It's basically a strategy to push America out of that part of the world. There's another part which has to do with the INF missile treaty that is no longer. And that is, China has been under no restraint to build sea-launched, air-launched, or ground-launched ballistic missiles between 500 kilometers and 5,000 kilometers. And as my friend Rick Fisher, and you know him well, that is the entire strategy to go after Taiwan. Without these missiles, they couldn't do it. So when the United States comes in and says, we're now going to test a INF-type missile, which we did just the other day, China and Russia both go crazy, and guess who also goes crazy? All the arms control groups in America mimic exactly what the Chinese and Russians do. If we could put these kind of missiles in South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, or Taiwan, God forbid, God willing, we would have a tremendous deterrent against the Chinese, and they know it, and we would be undoing their hegemonic strategy to kick us out of the Pacific. My view is, why is Hollywood, the academic community, the media, and certain radical politicians, why are they opposed to the United States deterring the bad guys? They have this kind of strange notion that they have to blame America, which they end up doing, making the bad guys, China and North Korea, look like the good guys, which is turning everything upside down.
They do it relentlessly, don't they? Peter, you've put a lot of food for thought on the table. I just want to say my own personal assessment is that when you build 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels in which we know they are secreting their missile programs, it's unlikely that you're going to confine yourself to 300, let alone.
Well, you're right. You're right. One of the things I did is I found out the Israelis had hired the Chinese to find out what kind of tunneling capability they had. And I asked my Israeli friends, I said, well, what'd they charge you per mile? And they gave me some numbers. And I went to Phil Carber, you know, the guy who discovered these things. And I said, if you build 3,000 miles of tunnels and put railroad tracks in them, the railroads go nowhere except for in the tunnels. What does that cost in American dollars? And that was 10 years ago. It was $66 billion. You don't build 60, you don't spend $66 billion on a, as some people said, a public works project to hide less, well, probably a couple hundred warheads max. So Carver said, he showed me pictures, Google Maps, and he said, see this? That's a missile launch capability just outside of the tunnel. And I said, holy mackerel, that's tilted. He said, yes. It's aimed at some place called Minot, North Dakota, Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Malmstrom, North Dakota, because if you look at the way the launch pad is, the distance of a DF-41 missile that they have in China reaches exactly our missile bases, which means, as we know, you hold at risk the other guy's weapons. You don't, this is obviously not a city busting philosophy. It could be first strike or second strike, who knows? But it tells you they're going for a very serious capability, not the kind of rhetoric we hear, which is, oh no, they're just thinking of busting up a couple of cities and it's retaliatory and they keep the warheads separate from missiles. And I asked some guy the other day, I said, you think they're building submarines to send them to sea to keep the warheads on land? Would be kind of like a, talk about a scarecrow.
This is the kind of nonsense that passes for strategic thinking in so many quarters in the United States. Peter Husey, look, the point is, as you understand so well and articulate so ably, the Chinese are deadly serious about us as the enemy. This is not just delusional expenditures on make-believe programs. Let me ask you quickly, Peter, one other thing before we have to let you go. This is a very short segment, but just quickly, you've spent a lot of time in and thinking about and studying and working with South Korea. Do you share my concern about what Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, is doing that seems designed to, well, enable and help prop up Kim Jong-un and really undermine President Trump's efforts to achieve the denuclearization of North Korea, another threat to us?
I understand your concern, and the problem is he's gotten way over his skis, but the leader of North Korea hasn't delivered him anything. So if anything, my view is it's weakening his position, which means he has to then go one more extra mile to try to make Kim up in North Korea happy in order to get a concession to go back to the South Korean people and say, hey, see, I got this. But because the North gives him at best superficial concessions, we have a real problem in that he's way over his skis. And my view is that will reinforce the Trump administration's philosophy is you got to be tough with the North because they ain't going to give you anything if you keep conceding. So you're right to be concerned. The fact is we have a, if we had a Jimmy Carter in office that would go along with the South with more and more concessions, boy, I would be really worried. But we have a very strong president that has said, you elected me, you chose me to go after China. Part of China's strategy is to arm North Korea with nuclear weapons in order to cut the relationship between the U.S. and South Korea. So yes, you are right to be concerned. I look at it a little differently. I think Kim Moon is so far over his skis that it's going to unravel and make him look less credible and in fact pave the way for a more conservative leader in South Korea.
Peter, we have to let you go. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's good to talk with you. We'll look forward to doing so again soon. Next up, Dr. Stephen Blank joins us. We'll talk with him about the newest threat from Russia and the very curious relationship between Russia and the communist Chinese. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of the country's preeminent authorities on, well, the old Soviet Union, now doing business as Russia. It is under the auspices of a man who loved the former and I think seems determined to try to replicate as much of the glory days of the old USSR as he can, Vladimir Putin. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank. These days, he is an independent consultant, but has for many years been one of the most important, I believe, educators about Russia and the Soviet Union and what is at stake in our relationship with the Kremlin and the dangers associated therewith. Dr. Blank has, among other things, written prolifically with over 1,000 articles on various issues, including many on the Soviet Union, Russia, and the like. He is also the author or editor of some 15 books, which is staggeringly impressive. He is a PhD from the University of Chicago and a good friend of this program. We're sorry we have not talked with him more frequently, but we're looking forward to remedying that in the days ahead. Dr. Blank, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you.
Good to be there.
I wanted to talk with you, Steve, as a guy who both understands Putin, I think, as well as anybody in the West, and is very, very mindful, of course, of the traditions of secrecy and maskarovka, the deception practiced by successive regimes there. What is going on, as you see it, with this so-called Skyfall nuclear-powered cruise missile, which has had apparently a series of accidents, including one that killed a number of top Russian scientists 2 weeks ago?
Well, to bring your listeners into this, there was the nuclear accident that occurred at an Arctic testing site at a place called Ninoska. The Skyfall, or in Russian, Burevestnik, Skyfall being the NATO designation for it, Burevestnik is a hypersonic nuclear cruise missile. That puts it outside, by the way, any arms control treaties that have existed up to now. It's an innovative weapon. And the Russians have built this because they are obsessed with building nuclear weapons that can evade the U.S. missile defense system, about which they're paranoid. They've vastly overinflated our capacities.
Well, and perhaps just to justify these extraordinarily expensive programs, but I hadn't heard that it was a hypersonic missile. That's a new twist on this.
Yes, it's the one. I believe it's the one that Putin, you know, showed on in March 2018 at his speech, where it goes around. It goes around the world. You can't track it, and so on.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, it's of infinite range. If it operates, that's the question, of course. So they had an accident. It seems as though this thing has actually blown up a couple of times. Our mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Mark Schneider, has said it's inherent in the nature of the thing that you're going to have nuclear release, because when it runs to its destination, among other things, it's certainly going to have that effect, among many others.
It's powered by a nuclear reactor, so you know, your listeners can imagine when they're on an airplane. When the airplane is flying, the airplane gasoline is coming out the back. Well, this would be nuclear waste. Well, you know, we know what that does. So, I mean, this is an inherently dangerous operation. Well, the U.S. rejected the idea about 50, 60 years ago. We looked at this. And we said no.
Putin is pursuing it, and he apparently is undeterred by the accidents and the, you know, radioactive releases and so on. But he's also engaged in, it seems, a pretty aggressive effort to cover it up, including shutting down, we're told, some of the monitoring sites of this Organization for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. This is not a surprise to you. You know how these guys operate. But what does it tell us about the nature of this, adversary, that it is going to such lengths to threaten us, A, and B, that it is perfectly prepared to deceive us, to lie about what it's up to?
Well, the lying and the concealment is inherent in Russian political culture, going back to the czars. The older listeners in the audience will remember Chernobyl. The reason we found out about Chernobyl, which is a much greater nuclear catastrophe, is because the seismological measurements in Sweden and Norway started going off the charts 3 days later.
The radiological.
Started going off the charts because, nobody would tell the boss what had happened near Chernobyl, and they figured we'd just tough it out. And, of course, this became a nightmare. Now, the same instinct is there throughout the Russian state apparatus, and no one's going to tell the truth to anybody about what happened, and certainly not to the main enemy, which is us. Second, they're obsessed with building nuclear weapons because they think that they cannot compete with us over time conventionally, as Mark Schneider has written. And, you know, I've said they've got 20 to 23 nuclear projects on the way right now. And they are obsessed that the U.S. missile defense, which can't do these things, but nevertheless they believe it, is going to take out their nuclear capabilities in some future battle. So they're trying to develop these weapons and Third, there's a tradition of buying scientific quackery by the government. It goes back at least to Stalin. It's somebody with a bright idea, but which is actually completely unfounded scientifically, comes to the boss and, you know, persuades them, this is a great idea, this will really give us what we need. And they say, sure, go ahead, damn the consequences. Well, here they are.
Well, let me switch gears on you. You mentioned the main enemy is the way the Russians view us. Another outfit that does as well, of course, is Communist China. And I was very interested in a piece that you were featured in Eurasia Times last month, Stephen Blank, along with another old friend of mine and yours, I know, Paul Goebel, talking about the relationship between Russia and China and how this can't end well with Russia. And yet Putin is all in terms of, you know, sort of a strategic partnership against the West, the United States specifically, and also, it must be said, enabling a lot of the Chinese buildup. Talk about that with us, if you would.
Well, Paul and I, we went to graduate school together, so I guess we still see things in a similar way. I believe it's an alliance, and it's getting worse. The recent aerial overflights by Russian Chinese planes in Japan and South Korea, the Russo-Chinese declarations of support for Iran and for Venezuela, arms sales exercises, all this, to me, it's an alliance, even though it may not be formally one on paper. And it's going to get worse. The problem Russia and China pose is that they are both ideologically as well as strategically perceiving themselves and representing themselves in the world as enemies of the United States and of liberalism, capital L, and therefore of American values and democracy and so on. They see us as being behind the demonstrations in Hong Kong and in Moscow, and have exchanged public statements to that effect. And they're allies. But the problem is that it's an asymmetric alliance. Moscow needs Beijing much more than Beijing needs Moscow. And the Chinese are gradually encroaching on hitherto on Russian interests where formerly China was not allowed in or involved. And the Russians can't do anything about it because they are economically unable to compete with China. We now see the Russians selling energy equities in the Arctic and elsewhere to China up till 2013. This was unheard of. We see Chinese building military bases in Central Asia, and the Russians are acquiescing.
So what do you think is going on in Vladimir Putin's head? I mean, he's certainly a shrewd enough guy to see where this is leading. Is it kind of an après-moi le déluge kind of view that it's going to be somebody else's problem? He'll ride this tiger for the foreseeable future?
Actually not, Frank. In 2013-14, they did a study. This is at the same time as they're getting ready to move into Crimea. They did a study, big interagency study, and you know how big these things are, which concluded that China would not be a problem for 15 years. There was an opportunity to make a lot of money selling weapons to China, and they could coalesce with China. And this was part of Putin's election platform when he came back in 2012. So they started going ahead and doing these things. Then comes Crimea, sanctions the deterioration of its relationship with the West, and they need Beijing much more than ever was the case before. So their calculation is that they can do these things, and they can eventually, you know, moderate the policy to a point where they don't have to be antagonistic to China, but they won't have to depend on it. I think it's a fundamentally wrong strategic calculation, but they bought into it because the Chinese are not going to give them lectures on democracy, and the Chinese are not going to overtly undermine their power. They're going to do so indirectly.
Yeah. Well, just tease that out with me quickly, Steve Blank. You mentioned encroaching on the interests of Russia. The Chinese are also, the last time I checked, encroaching on Russia itself, including, you know, having large numbers of Chinese now living there and companies exploiting its resources and the like in a way that certainly looks as though it's setting up for, well, perhaps a takeover of some kind.
Well, no. Actually, look, you're mistaken here. Actually, there are not a lot of Chinese living in Siberia, and for very good reasons. Very few people want to live in Siberia for the obvious reason. It's a hard place to live. Now, there is a lot of Chinese, there's a fair amount of Chinese activity. For example, they're cutting down forests because Chinese timber demands are so great. But the Chinese are not colonizing Siberia with Chinese settlers. This is a myth that people have conjured up. What is happening, though, is economically they have enormous leverage in China, in Siberia.
Well, as you know very well, things are not necessarily done on an all-volunteer basis in China, and I would be surprised if those interests over time don't translate into more of a presence there, too. But in any event, the point is the nature of this relationship is unlikely to be over time conducive to an independent, sovereign Russia, I think, and China's on the march.
Well, over time, China is strengthening its positions in what is now called Eurasia at Russia's expense, economically. And also, for example, the Pentagon reported that there was a Chinese nuclear submarines were in the Arctic, if you read the annual China report. You know, that doesn't happen without the Russians allowing it, and that's unprecedented.
Part of this larger strategic alliance at the moment that has such ominous implications both in Asia and, I believe, elsewhere around the world. Stephen Blank, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as the cumulative service you've provided to our country in terms of your expertise on all of these matters. We look forward to a further, much more lengthy visit with you in the near future, if we may. Next up, we will speak with Charles Jacobs straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm always pleased to say, joined by Ambassador Yoram Ettinger, a man who served with great distinction his government, that of the State of Israel, in Washington, rising to the rank of Minister for Congressional Affairs in the Israeli Embassy in Washington. He was also the Consul General of Israel for the southwestern United States. These days, he's commenting and writing volubly and otherwise contributing to the public policy debate in Israel, notably through the Ettinger Report. It's always a delight, as I say, to have you with us, Mr. Besser. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
I'm interested in picking your brains about several very important and somewhat controversial topics, if I can, Mr. Besser. Quickly, you have written recently in one of your outlets about the importance and success of foreign investment in Israel. And I think this is a generally commendable thing. I know there's an awful lot of it from the United States, but of some concern, I believe, to the Trump administration and to many of us who are friends of Israel, is the investment that is coming from communist China in the port of Haifa and in some of your technology companies, facial recognition, and perhaps even weapon systems. Talk us through what that looks like from your perspective.
Well, I'm also very much concerned about the potential of growing Chinese presence in Israel. On one hand, it's another reaffirmation of Israel's enhanced profile in the world of high tech in general and foreign investment in particular. But then we are aware here in Israel that China has its own ties with some of the bad guys in the world, and China itself sometimes can be classified as a member of the group of the bad guys. As far as I know, and I qualified as far as I know, there is a growing caution here in Israel about the Chinese profile. The Chinese would like to expand their investment in a much faster manner, and Israel, and especially the Israeli sensitive high-tech industries, have become much more careful about expanding their ties with China. But generally speaking, I fully agree with you that China must not get access to sensitive technologies, cyber, and other such technologies that have dual use and may end up in Tehran or in Damascus or, who knows, North Korea. And that certainly is an element to consider.
One small caveat that I would offer is I think it's actually the case that China is involved with all of the bad guys. I can't think of a one that it isn't tied to. And in fact, it's becoming clear that it's and sees itself as sort of the leader of that block. So I appreciate very much your concerns as well.
But again, the point which should be made, the vast majority of foreign investments in Israel at this stage are American investments. Over 250 of the top American high-tech companies maintain research and development centers in Israel, which consist of Israeli startups which were acquired by the Intels and the Microsoft and the Google and the Facebook of the USA. So in that respect, we welcome it greatly, but certainly there's a growing reservation and growing awareness about the Chinese element.
Well, that's good news as far as I'm concerned, and I hope we'll see more of the former and a lot less of the latter. Let me switch gears on you, Ambassador. We've had, of course, a recent controversy over a, well, aborted, I guess you might say, visit by Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, two female Muslim members of Congress, to what they quite provocatively called Palestine. It didn't happen. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about it. I know back early on, you wrote in your Edinger report a kind of endorsement of Ambassador Ron Dermer's recommendation that they be allowed to come. The president thought differently. The prime minister ultimately thought differently. A humanitarian exemption was offered, of course, to Rashida Tlaib. She declined it and now has made very clear, as has Ilhan Omar, her wingman or woman, I guess you might say, that this was basically all about an opportunity to bash Israel and promote this so-called boycott, divestment, sanctions agenda that they both very strongly favor. Give us your reflection, if you would, on how this whole thing has played out and whether it is, in fact, the case that, as Israeli law requires, as I understand it, people who advocate for BDS should not be admitted to the country, whether they're in Congress or otherwise.
Well, I must say that I still stick to my position, which has been allowing them to come in while not ignoring their anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and in fact, in my mind, anti-American world view. However, my position is that Israel is dramatically strong enough to absorb such a visit, and that the visit should not be out of any respect for them, but out of respect for the institution which they belong to. If they would not be members of Congress, then I would certainly be against issuing a visa to them. But I feel that out of respect for the U.S. legislature, it's incumbent upon Israel to accept any congressman and any congresswoman, while obviously making clear Israel's own reservations. Their aim has been to provoke against Israel. Their aim has been to inflate artificially their position. And I feel that by barring them, we certainly have self-inflicted wound of provocation, which they succeeded, and we also have contributed to the artificial inflation of value. Because let's face it, with all the well-deserved concern for their activities, they represent a tiny element on Capitol Hill. Only a month ago, there was a vote on the issue of boycott and divestment sanctions of Israel. 398 members of the House voted against BDS. Only 17 voted for it, and they were part of the 17, which I believe reflects their real position. By barring them, we inflate their importance, and I don't think that this should have been committed.
If I may say, sounds like a former minister for congressional affairs speaking, a man who clearly values the institution of the United States Congress, and I get that.
I value it, Frank, but as you know, Congress has been the most consistent, systematic supporter of enhanced U.S.-Israel cooperation, militarily, commercially.
Mr. Ambassador, this is the concern, and I take your point about the vote on the BDS resolution. it was heartening. But I also think it is somewhat contradictory to the way a lot of members of Congress have been voting, and particularly in the Democratic caucus of late, on, among other things, these congresswomen and their views. They have, as you know, been given an awful lot of slack, if not actual political cover. This has prompted, of course, the president, Donald Trump, to, well, inveigh against what is happening within the Democratic Party on this account, in particular among the Jewish members of Congress and the Jewish community more generally in this country. Would you care to comment on his concerns about what seems to be a rising tide of, well, maybe anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism within the Democratic cohort?
Well, I fully embrace President Trump's concern. And by the way, not because of the attitude towards Israel, but because of, in my mind, lack of awareness by a large number of Democratic legislators to global affairs, to the significance of different developments in the Middle East and throughout the world. For instance, the vast majority of the Democratic legislators do not realize that Donald Trump's position on Israel is a derivative of America first, not Israel first, America first. The president understands that recognizing Israel's sovereignty on the Golan Heights constrains the moves of Iran, of Russia, of Syria, and bolsters homeland security in Jordan. Therefore, for America's interest, it's better for Israel to be on the Golan Heights rather than off the Golan Heights. For American interest, it's important to relocate the American embassy to Jerusalem and send a signal to Arab leaders. Gone are the days when American presidents were frightened by Arab pressure and Arab threats. This president is not to be threatened. This president does the right thing. Now, all those elements obviously are good for Israel, but the primary reason for the President Trump to follow such a policy is out of concern for America's interest, as certainly has been the case with Iran. The agreement with Iran was disastrous. It could have produced a catastrophe upon the world, upon the U.S., upon the Middle East. By pulling out of the agreement, the president, in my mind, has contributed to global stability.
God bless you, Mr. Ambassador. It's great to talk with you as always. We'll look forward to talking with you again very soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Charles Jacobs, a remarkable entrepreneur as well as thinker and advocate for freedom in the battle space of the war of ideas. These days, he is the driving force behind Americans for Peace and Tolerance, a very important organization in many respects, but in particular one that we'll be discussing today in connection with a project it has been mounting for some time, the American Anti-Slavery Group. This is about slavery in our own time. There's a lot of talk about, you know, reparations for slavery in America and how America was founded with the original sin of slavery and so on. And one can have that debate. But what cannot be debated, tragically, is that in our time, there is this phenomenon of slavery continuing. And we're going to talk with a man who has studied it closely and has worked tirelessly to bring it to an end. Charles Jacobs, welcome back. It's so good to have you, sir.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's good to hear your voice again.
Good to talk with you, sir. So, Dr. Jacobs, there is a source, it seems, for much of, if not virtually all of the enslavement of people that is taking place in the literal sense. I'm not talking about the, you know, totalitarian regimes that enslave their populations and so on. That's another horror. But I'm talking about physical bondage and the, you know, incarceration against their will, or the forced labor of people as modern day slaves. What is that source, as you see it?
Well, today there's many different sorts of slavery around the world. We've heard about sex trafficking and forced labor and debt bondage and all of that. But the kind of slavery that Americans know best, and the worst, of course, sort, is chattel slavery, where people are owned, captured, bought, sold, owned, and traded. And these are traded by Arab and Muslim masters in five African countries. And as we speak today, there's over half a million, maybe three quarters of a million black men, women, and children who are bought and sold and owned and rented.
Say that again. How many?
Between a half a million and three quarters of a million slaves. And they're owned by Arabs and Muslims. And that's probably the reason why the human rights community shies away from this, because it's not their focus to point out the crimes and sins of non-Westerners, really.
And what is the source within Islam of this practice? Is that easily identified?
Well, yeah. I mean, Muhammad himself is seen as the perfect man to be emulated in every aspect of his life, and he had slaves. And there hasn't been, as in the West, where we own slaves as well. There was a huge liberationist, abolitionist movement, and we corrected that terrible error and sin. And in Islam, this has not been corrected.
Now, there are parts of the Muslim world, apparently, where it is not practiced, but you've focused in on five countries. These are all in Africa, is that right?
These are African countries, right. So you just to go through the list, in Sudan, as you know, there was a jihad by the Islamist regime in Khartoum in the north against the black, mostly Christian south, in which 2 or 3 or maybe 4 million people were slaughtered. It was kind of a hidden Holocaust, actually. And as part of the onslaught, slavery was the terror weapon of choice. And as many as hundreds of thousands of black, mostly women and girls, were enslaved by the raiders as they stormed Christian villages, shot the men. This kind of slavery wasn't like, you know, we had in the West, where you needed musculature for plantation work. This was to spread Islam, first of all, to humiliate, but then to spread Islam through the womb of the captured slave women. So these are the vast majority are women and children. And they're enslaved.
Yeah. And is it the case, Dr. Charles Jacobs, that in places like Saudi Arabia, that there is no slavery? I've heard reports to the contrary.
Well, it's very difficult to actually find out the case, but many, many people believe that slavery persists. And why shouldn't it? You know, even the New York Times, my goodness, pigs fly, had a report last week by a reporter named Declan Walsh, who I don't like for many reasons, but I was stunned to read that he did an entire report on racism in the Arab world. And, if the New York Times is telling you that there's racism in the Arab world, by golly, that must be true. So in places like Saudi Arabia, one can be sure, but I don't have direct documentation, nor I think does anyone.
And accompanying the racism would be this enslavement of people of that inferior race, as they see it.
Sure. I mean, like, just take the case of, I think to me, one of the most fascinating cases is Mauritania. And in Mauritania, as part of the global jihad, Arab Muslims conquered that land 800 years ago and then converted forcibly the Africans to Islam. Well, that didn't stop Arab Berbers who own and run the place from enslaving blacks who think that they're Muslims. So here you have a case of, I mean, think of the phrase, black Muslim slaves serving Arab masters. And in Mauritania, that continues to this day. You can buy and sell.
Just quickly, Sudan, Mauritania, what are the other three African countries?
Okay, so we know about Nigeria mostly because, Michelle Obama had a fit one day when she heard that Boko Haram, which is related to ISIS, which is an Islamist group, was killing and enslaving African women in Nigeria. And so for a minute and a half, she got annoyed. And there was this hashtag Save Our Girls effort, which bring back our girls, which, you know, just evaporated, you know, 4 minutes later, because, again, all the ideology around Westerners daring to criticize evil deeds of people of color or of Islamists or of Muslims or whatever.
Jihadists.
Right. So, and then right now, as you know, in Nigeria, there's a massacre of Christians by Muslims. And as part of that, also, there is this enslavement kind of like in Sudan. Also, as blacks flee these violent places to try to make their way to Europe, they're captured and caught in Libya and Algeria. And indeed, CNN has an incredible video clip of an auction where a black man is being sold, and the price wound up at $400. So you can actually see a CNN clip of a slave trade.
Yeah, and is this at your website, iabolish.org?
www.iabolish.org.
We're going to run out of time before we run out of things to ask you about this, Charles Jacobs. But let me just ask you specifically, you talked about Michelle Obama's ephemeral interest in this subject and that of others because of the political correctness or other pressures not to give offense to, well, what I think of as Sharia supremacists. And very quickly, just tell us a little bit about some of those who you have pointedly called out for turning a blind eye, at least intermittently. Al Sharpton, for example, Keith Ellison, and Louis Farrakhan.
Well, okay, quickly. I just published a piece in American Thinker reminding people that in 2001, Al Sharpton went to Sudan. He was contemplating a run for the presidency. And he went with our ally, Christian Solidarity International. He saw the slaves. He spoke to redeemed and liberated slaves. They told him of their plight. He said he was out, quote, "It's outrageous that no nationally known civil rights group has gone over to Africa to criticize what is happening there." And when a woman said, "Does anybody know?" Sharpton says, "Well, they will now because I'm going to go tell them." Well, then he came back to the United States, met with Louis Farrakhan and his group, where he was read the Riot Act. Don't you dare. Don't you dare. Because to Farrakhan and that group and to Sharpton, you don't want to take the focus off of, American sin. And for sure, you don't want to go against Farrakhan's main message to black people, which is that Islam is the path to authentic freedom.
Charles Jacobs, thank you for this work. Check it out at iabolish.org. Come back to us again soon, if you will, sir. Next week, I hope the rest of you will do the same. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.